when an actor is really spontaneous, really living alive in the moment, they are touching their subconscious. What they're hitting is not in their control.
Welcome to the Behind the Scenes podcast. This is Michael Golab. Today I'm talking to Mike Alfreds. Mike is a theatre director, adapter, translator and teacher. He talks about the role of the subconscious, the essence of good storytelling, what it means to be really alive in a performance, what we can learn from film and theatre stars, the danger of overconfidence, the importance of always being 100% ready to work, the significance of curiosity and playfulness, the power of looking at a scene and situation through someone else's eyes, the difference between making things happen and allowing things to happen, and so much more. Mike founded and was Artistic Director of Shared Experience, directed for the Royal National Theatre, Shakespeare's Globe and the Royal Shakespeare Company. He worked in over 200 productions all over the world. Mike's also known for his special method of instructing actors, inspired by the principles of Konstantin Stanislavski and Rudolf Laban, with emphasis on physical activity, spontaneity and interaction with others. He's written two books, Different Every Night, which describes his approach to theatre and his rehearsal process when working on plays, and Then What Happens, which describes his techniques when working on adaptations and storytelling. His system of working and his thoughts on the making of theatre have been said to be as crucial and illuminating as Stanislavski's and Peter Brook's. Mark Ryland said about Mike, "If I was allowed to train again to be an actor, but I was only allowed one teacher, it'd have to be Mike Alfreds. To me, he's a genius when it comes to acting and storytelling. And now, I bring you Mike Alfreds." Hi, Mike.
Hi, Michael.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Such an honor to have you here.
Oh.
So my very first question would be, what do you love the most about being a director and a teacher?
I suppose being a director means that you are sort of in touch with so many different areas of experience. I think what I really love about directing and teaching is that I'm dealing with human beings. That is, for me, the most interesting aspect of my work. Everything else comes very much secondary to that. You know, I love great scripts, and it's lovely to have beautiful visual things and a lot of technical stuff. But what really interests me in theatre is the human being in action. And through my years working with actors, I've learned so much about just being a human being, how we function, how we work psychologically, individually, as groups, and so forth. And I've accumulated an amazing amount of unsuspected knowledge, as it were. Often I hear neuroscientists saying, "Oh, we've discovered that such and such about how people function psychologically." And I'm thinking, well, I could have told you that about 15 years ago. Because one of the interesting things that I've just come to realize quite recently is that spending most of one's life in a rehearsal room, you're in a very intense laboratory observing human nature, and you're watching three levels of psychological relationships at the same time. You're exploring the relationship of the characters in the play to each other. You're exploring the relationship of the actor to the role he or she is playing. And then there is the whole psychology of the people in the room at the rehearsal. You know, the actors, the stage management, myself, and so forth and so on. So you're really in a hothouse, you know, working under quite intense conditions, observing wittingly and unwittingly human behavior. And so you're acquiring a huge amount of knowledge, which hopefully is informing how you function as a human being.
And how does it inform you as you function?
Well, I hope it's made me a little bit wiser, knowing how to handle actors. I was very naive when I started working with actors. I just thought about the work. I didn't think about the relationship. I just assumed that when you got into a rehearsal room, everybody wanted to be there happily and just got on with it. And it took me a long time to realize that everybody comes with their own agendas. People are nervous, people are frightened, people are arrogant, people are egocentric, and so forth. People are shy, and you've got to absorb all these things, and first of all observe them, then absorb them into yourself, and then create the conditions where you eliminate all the sort of negative aspects of the psychology and try to create healthy working conditions where the actors will be free to be truly creative, to be open and spontaneous. So, I mean, that's a learning process. And, you know, I've been doing it now for got over 60 years. I've been directing, amazing as it may seem. And I'm still learning. Now, when I look back and when I started at the age of 20, I sort of blush to think I could stand up in front of a whole group of actors and say to them, this is what you have to do. You know, luckily my instinct was good, but I knew nothing, really.
So I was lucky, you know, I was lucky to see a few, to witness a few of your rehearsals and to see a few of your productions. And I've always been fascinated by your approach because I've noticed that actors are suddenly, they were suddenly very bold, alive and in the moment, trying new things. And it was just extraordinary to watch. So in these moments, the immediacy, danger and the power of a live performance were really palpable. And I was wondering, I mean, I read your two absolutely amazing books, especially the Different Every Night is, I think, should be compulsory for every actor and director, because it's such a well of wisdom. And then what happens is for adapting
storytelling,
storytelling, yeah, which is brilliant as well. But I find especially the first one for any actor and director is just amazing. And I'm just wondering, how do you create an atmosphere in the rehearsal room where actors are not scared to fail, which ironically makes them follow their subconscious impulses and be more alive?
Well, first of all, I've got a method of working which encourages the actors to be free. You see, one of the things I realized when I'd been directing quite well for about 15 years, that I'd never thought about what theatre really was. I was attracted to it. I was just working in it. And I didn't really think much about what it really means to be a director. So I started asking myself questions. And the main one was, why am I working in theatre? And this would often occur to me because I'd go to the theatre and I'd be so disappointed with most of what I saw, including my own work. And I thought, why am I working in this medium? It seems so creaky and stiff. And maybe it's, you know, it's past its use by date, you know, it's dead, but it doesn't know it and it won't lie down. So I thought to myself, what, you know, and this was way before digital technology, but there was a lot of television and of course movies. And I thought maybe live theatre is irrelevant anymore. Maybe, you know, television and film are giving us everything we need. And I thought, no, that really can't be. After 2,500 years of recorded theatre, why should it suddenly stop now? So I literally sat down and started to make lists. And I tried to make a list of what theatre had to offer, which was utterly unique to theatre. And the first thing that came along was that it's live. You know, that terrible cliche, you know, live theatre. You think, well, yes, it's called live theatre, but when I go to see it, I don't think it's live. And so I thought, well, a rock, you know, rock concert, a gig is live, a concert is live, a lecture is live.
Yeah.
You know, a dramatic reading is live. What's different about theatre? And then the other thing that came to me was, well, in theatre, a group of human beings who are just like the audience get up in front of the audience and say to them, we are going to pretend to be other people and you are going to believe us.
Yeah.
You know, and it seems to me the equation for theatre is A, transforms themselves into B for the pleasure education of C. And then I pursued this thing about what does live really mean? The actors, all the actors I see in shows, they're live, they're walking around, it's happening now. But most of our training and most of the conventions of theatre is that you work in rehearsals, you discover what you want to do, you fix it, and then you keep repeating it. Yeah. And this seemed to me the antithesis of live and free, because as soon as you start repeating, it's no longer live. It's a sort of virtual reality. You're not doing what's happening now. You're trying to recreate what happened yesterday or last night or a week ago or 10 days ago or a month ago in rehearsal. And so I started developing a way of working in which the actors could really be spontaneous every night and every moment. And so although you rehearsed very rigorously, when they came on stage, they would have to deal with what was happening at that moment between them and the other actors, and also how they were feeling at that moment, what occurred to them. And they and the other actors had to be open to respond. So people were playing in the moment really spontaneously. You know, they weren't really in the moment, because I know a lot of actors have said over the years, oh, I always try to play as if for the first time. And I thought, why do it as if for the first time? Do it for the first time, you know. And so this requires a huge amount of discipline. It's not anarchic, it's not chaotic, quite the opposite. The actor has to develop a lot of inner disciplines. First of all, if they're working with a play and it's not an improvisation, that the text is sacrosanct and they can't improvise it. But how they say it and how they play it is totally free to be explored in the moment. Then they have the whole discipline of what their character's objectives were. I'm a great believer in Stanislavski. I think he was an amazing innovator, never quite given credit for what he did, which we can talk about at some other point. And so as long as the actor, as the character, comes into a scene with their intention very clearly, trying to get what they want from the other people or from the audience, they have to respond to what they're actually getting from those people at that moment. And so you set up a whole series of sort of very disciplined improvisation. And all I can tell you is that I've done shows that have toured a lot and done, say, 100, 150 performances. And with particular groups of actors, it has just been amazing how much variety they can discover in a scene, how it is always fresh and there's always something new to discover. It is endless. One line has so many implications, can be said and played in so many different ways, and the scene can be played in so many different ways and still be true to the characters and still be true to the text. So once the actors embrace this work, they feel trusted, they feel respected, because I'm saying I want it to be free for you to create from the first day of rehearsal to the very last performance. And so they feel they're being given their right dues and they're not obeying the dictates of a director, however benevolent.
It feels like they don't need to be good. They're allowed to fail, which ironically makes them so much better.
Yes, because you see, if you're trying to get it right, why you cannot, if you're doing everything the way you always do it, how can you be spontaneous if you know how you're going to play the line, how your partner is going to respond, and how you're going to react to that? So you're anticipating the results rather than allowing things to be genuinely unexpected. I think the one thing that an actor cannot pretend is to be spontaneous. You're either spontaneous or you're not. What's even deeper into this is the fact that when an actor is really spontaneous, really living alive in the moment, they are touching their subconscious. What they're hitting is not in their control and they're having to go with it.
How can you train that, Mike? Is there a way to...
That's all part of the work. You see, look, I'm talking to you. You've asked me a question. I know more or less what I'm going to say to you. but I don't exactly know how I'm going to say it or whether you're going to interrupt me or comment on me. So I'm having to be spontaneous while trying to pursue, you know, my objective, which is to answer your question.
Yeah.
But it's open to all variation. You know, a new idea may occur to me in the middle of one sentence and so forth and so on. You may suddenly cut me short and take me on to another question. But we always have our intention there, which we're trying as best as we can to pursue. So it all comes together. I mean, it's a great big package. And it's really the act of getting used to thinking this way and working this way. It means that the actors have to get in out of their heads and into their bodies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is more difficult than it seems.
In a way, it is like going to the gym as well, isn't it? You can train that, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Because I often say to actors, you must treat yourself like professional
athletes.
Athletes, absolutely. You are athletes. And you've got to look after your bodies and everything. You've got to be in good working condition. And one of the very appalling things that's occurred to me, particularly since we've been locked down and working on Zoom, and I watch actors, and they're so, on the whole, unprepared to do the job they've chosen to do. They come with low energy. They don't come in a good physical state of aliveness and alertness, upright, ready to go. They wait to be sort of prodded and pushed by the director. They're serious. They want to work. They care. But the conditions of the business of being an actor doesn't allow them or make it necessary for them to come into a rehearsal room in the right state to work. And this was made very, very strong for me by watching some videos of wonderful dancers for the Netherlands Dance Company. And there they are, so alive, so immediate, so in touch with every aspect of their body, so much technique and immediacy and wit and style and precision and freedom. And I thought, my God, most actors are light years away from that. But of course, to a certain degree, the dancer has to be in pretty good shape even to start. So the nature of their job demands that. Unfortunately, most people think acting's about walking and talking and feeling. And everybody does that. So there's no training, there's no sort of program automatically for you. You know, there's no daily class unless you devise one for yourself, which you can do. No, most actors, and because actors are working very infrequently, you know, it's very chaotic. They're busy, then they're not very busy, then they're doing 2 days on a telly, then they're rehearsing a month on a show which is going on tour, then they've got a bit part here, then they're in a movie. You know, it's all, so they're not working constantly and consistently.
Yeah, and it's tricky to keep yourself ready, like you said, when you're not working constantly and consistently. And I think Hamlet said, isn't it? Hamlet said, the readiness is all.
Yes, absolutely.
Just made me think of it when you spoke about actors having to be ready for a rehearsal to start and not needing to be prodded.
Yes, absolutely. It's not that it's laziness or bad will, but it's just also most actors don't have a clear way of working. They're very dependent upon the directors they work with. Most of the drama schools try to give them a little bit of everything and end up giving them not very much. So they end up with... They end up not having a lot of tools at their equipment. The actors need much, much more craft. So that whatever comes along, they say, oh, I can use a bit of Laban. Oh, I can use a bit of Grotowski. Oh, I can use some Michael Chekhov. Oh, I can use my voice in this way. Oh, I can use my body in this way. Oh, I can do some Felsenkreis.
Oh, wow. That's such a great point. It's also because there's this old saying, like, to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So in a way, if you only have one tool, you're just going to overuse it.
Yes, and so they get locked into doing what works for them. It's also exacerbated by the fact that there are rehearsal times are never very long. They're never long enough to do the serious work. And also, a lot of directors aren't very interested in the actor process. They're very busy, particularly nowadays with so much technology, with all the digital stuff, with the sound, with the effects. And so the actors don't have much chance to train or to develop. So the actor needs to come with a huge amount of preparation, you know, really honed and, you know, ready to go in any direction, you know. And but what actors do is they rely on what they know, and they fall into this pattern of repeating what is their comfort zone, because it works for them. But ultimately, most actors become very boring because you know exactly what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. They tend to lose range. It's like muscles which atrophy. Even watching, because we've been locked in, I've been watching lots and lots of television series, you know, drama series, which I never used to watch very much. And you watch something that's been going for five series, shall we say. You start thinking, oh, that actor's rather nice. And then as time goes on, you think they're doing the same thing every week. They're finding nothing
again,
new. They're not finding a special moment. They're not surprising me. They're not moving me. They're just on automatic, doing what they do very, very slickly, very cleverly, very nicely. But it's very competent. It's very good. It's okay. But I'm never surprised. I'm never amazed. I'm never made to think, oh, wow, I've never thought that character could be like that. Oh, my God, I know how that character felt. You know, I don't have any moments of real revelation.
And surprise, yeah. Is there anything you particularly enjoyed, any series you found?
Yes, I mean, I found a lot of actually Scandinavian stuff, which is much, much better. It seems they probe into the characters with more detail, and they're much, much more interesting. And there's a wonderful French series called Spiral.
Spiral.
Which is incredibly witty and inventive. And oh, I don't know, I just got very excited by that. And the actors seem a little freer in that because the script demands of them more variety.
Yeah. What are the Scandinavian ones called?
I've forgotten as many as I remember. There's a very good one. There's two ones called The Bridge, where one of the detectives, she's autistic. And that's wonderful. Very clever. They're really interesting. I wish I could remember. I've seen an awful lot of them over the last 6 months.
Yeah, it's been a long 6 months.
There's a very good Spanish one called Night and Day, which I like very much. Before We Die is another one. A lot of these are on Form 4, Walter Presents, world television series. Very good.
Oh, great. Thanks.
You know, fell for. So, I mean, they're great.
And Mike?
Yeah.
I also wonder, is there anything that you find applicable from all your knowledge as a theatre director in your daily life? Is there anything you find yourself applying on a daily basis?
Oh, I just think it's handling people. It's very difficult for me to know. I feel I've changed. I feel I'm more patient than I used to be. I think I listen a bit more carefully. I've learned not to be quite so reactive and give myself a moment. I've learned not to be quite so defensive about my own work when I'm criticized. I think, there are degrees, obviously. I've learned to be a little more tolerant, not to be so ideologically fixated that you become blocked. And also watching how divided society has become. You know, you look at America, you look at England now with Brexit and with the coronavirus and Trump and so forth, that actually you must know when you can compromise. You've got to be pragmatic. You can't cling to your beliefs exclusively because it's death. It just pushes everything to extremes. You've got to think, what do the other people want? It's not just what I want. They're wrong and I'm right. It's ridiculous. And so you learn also to do quite a lot of lateral thinking. I'm a great believer in this guy, Edward de Bono, who in the 60s and 70s, maybe 80s, he was writing lots and lots of books about lateral thinking and techniques for being open to discuss, to debate, to discover, to be creative. And this applies very much, I think.
What's that book called?
Oh, dozens. He wrote about 40 of them.
40, okay. Edward de Bono.
De Bono, yes. I am right, you are wrong. Lateral thinking for business. There's masses of them. I could go to my bookcase and he did a lot of stuff for children as well.
And it's all worth a read?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, great.
Well, not
great
all of them. I mean, masses of them with lots of exercises and games and...
Oh, nice.
You know, yes, I mean, really interesting.
Do you meditate?
No.
You don't?
No. Years and years ago, I took up meditation, but I found it very creepy because you used to go for these sort of checkups to these centres where you were given you're given a syllable. I forgot what it's called now.
Oh, I know. You mean transcendental meditation?
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Yes. You go. You
the
get,
mantra. Mantra.
You know, your mantra, whatever it is. Well, it's, yeah. Anyway. Anyway, I'd go and there'd be people waiting and they'd all be very serene. And they'd say, have you been doing this long? Our family find this so wonderful. And it was all so lacking in vitality. It was also, you know, we're so calm and serene. I thought, no, I don't want to be like that. No, I was much younger, you know, so I crept away from it.
I see. But I think that's meditation gone wrong, I think. I don't think...
Well, it's people being converts, I guess. No,
yeah.
I mean, I can see actually meditating is very good because basically what's it saying is for 2.5 hours a day, just switch your mind off.
Yeah. Or at least observe how crazy it is because we don't even see it. Yeah.
As I've got older, I don't do it continuously, but there are periods when my day is structured this way that in the early afternoon, I'll have a half an hour nap, but I lie on my back and I just close my eyes. But I don't exactly fall asleep, but I just let myself drift off. And I think that's an equivalent of meditating. The mind just goes where it goes and you lose all sense of time. And I find that quite refreshing. So,
oh yeah, I'm sure that's a form of meditation because I think a lot of people think that meditation is about not thinking, but actually I think it's more about not thinking.
Yeah,
we're just made to think, unfortunately and fortunately.
It's like breathing, but you can just allow the thoughts rather than...
Not attach yourself to every thought and identify
exactly.
With every thought.
And if you start thinking about things which are worrying you, sort of give yourself instructions, go away from that, just breathe. So often what I do is... I'll just really just do a lot of deep breathing and concentrate on the breathing, put the mind on the breathing, which takes you away from those.
Well, that is basically the definition of meditation, Mike. It's like you concentrate on your breathing, so you are meditating.
Well, there I am, you see.
Yeah, there you are.
There you go.
What advice would you give to your younger self? What do you wish you would have known in your 20s, 30s?
All the things I've just listed for you.
Okay.
You see, when I work with directors and teachers, I'm often saying to them, relationships are 50% of your job. And when I was training, it was a wonderful training. I trained in America at a very good theatre department to the Carnegie Institute of Technology in Pittsburgh. 3 years intensive work. But they never talked about relationships. It was always about the work, the play, the analysis. You're dealing... with actors who are vulnerable. And you've got to respect the fact that what you're asking an actor to do is very challenging. Okay, the actor decided he or she wanted to be an actor, rightly or wrongly. But nevertheless, they are putting themselves, if they're good, they're putting themselves in a very vulnerable, open condition to explore whatever the script needs. Because I think most directors, they sit behind their desk with their scripts and they say, go over there and be sexy for me, please. Go over there and be aggressive. Go over there and be masochistic. Go over there and be thoroughly unpleasant. And the actors very dutifully go and do that. The director doesn't do anything. You sit there saying, oh, yeah, no, you weren't being sexy enough, you weren't being aggressive enough. And those are areas, even for the most open people, of which are delicate. And so you have to ease people into that so they go there instinctively and naturally and want to go there because it's good for the work. So it's really developing a mindset with your cast about working. And I suppose the other thing I would have given advice to myself as a young director would be, when you're casting, make sure that you're very open with the actors. Tell them how you work, because otherwise you start off at cross purposes. And also I learned that if you don't explain, they say, oh, I can't work like that. I remember one of my very early jobs, I came back from America to England, and I was doing a job at 2-week rehearsal in an English rep theatre. And I brought all my awful American improvisational ways with me. And at the first reading, I said to the actors, now I want you to read each other's roles, because I always felt if you're reading your own role, you're not listening to the play. Well, the reaction, resentment and the resistance I got, no, that I was contracted to play this role, and this is my how I helps me to learn my line. So I got everything I suggested was blocked. And at that point, I actually thought, I don't want to work in theatre anymore. I really don't. If this is what English theatre's like, I don't want to go anywhere near it. Anyway, time changes. And as I developed my way of working, I started to say, I'd meet an actor and I'd say, look, this is the way I work. I do not fix anything. You do not fix anything. Everything is open-ended. Now, if that doesn't appeal to you, I quite understand, but that's the way I work. And even then, suddenly, in the last week of rehearsals, the actor would say to me, when are we going to fix everything? When are we blocking it? And I said, but I told you in the first meeting, this is the way I work. Oh, I didn't realize you meant that. Or they'd forgotten. So now, when I meet actors, I don't tell them once, I tell them twice, I tell them three times, and I say to them, will you repeat back to me what I said? Do you understand? Because one of the problems with actors, when they come to see you for a role, mainly they want to put on a good face and they want to get the part, they want to get the job. So they're giving out a lot of energy of enthusiasm and they're not listening. Their ears get blocked because their energy is going, yes, yes, how interesting, how lovely. I'd love to work with you. And rather than sitting back and listening and asking their own questions.
Yeah. So by making them repeat it, you're basically making sure they've understood what they're signing up for.
They can't say, I didn't understand. And also I say to actors, look, ask me questions. If you come to meet me for a role, it's a two-way conversation. It's a two-way transaction. Ask me about me and how I work. Ask me any questions you need to know. Those sort of things I wish I'd known when I was much younger. I'd have spared myself a lot of pain and confusion and some actors a lot of possible unhappiness.
It's got to do with clear communication, like
you said.
And with relationships. How do you get better at relationships? Is it just time? And
first of all, it's being aware that they exist.
Yeah.
And also being open to realize when you are doing something wrong.
Yeah.
You see, a lot of people...
Ego.
Yeah, ego keeps them in denial.
So the
actor's always wrong, or the director's always wrong. It's not me. And that comes with time, because after a while you can look back and you can see a certain pattern in your behavior. And you can say, oh my God, look, I always have done that in that sort of situation. I must learn to change. Now, you don't learn to change immediately, but once you've acknowledged the fact, you've accepted that fact, you find that you will change. I mean, that's the positive side of living. that you're growing and learning. Otherwise, why go on living, you know?
I mean,
if you're not going to improve and become some sort of better person.
Mm.
But if you always feel you're right and you always feel you need, I mean, look at the American president. He's the most appalling species of a human being you can imagine. I mean, his arrogance, his manipulative slyness, his need to be the right, to be right, to be always right, to lie, to deny anything that works against him is unbearable. I mean, it's appalling. I mean, he is the epitome of pure narcissism, which is incredibly destructive, lacking in empathy. But you've got to learn. I mean, it may have made me a little less demanding of the actors when I compare my productions in the present with the past. Sometimes I feel, have they lost the edge they had, which might have been me bullying in a sort of way, not exactly bullying, but going on and on at the actors till I got them to go where I would like them to go. And now I go with a lot of times of where the actors go, as long as I feel it's right for the show. And I'm not sure, it's difficult for me to tell. I don't know, but it's interesting. It's interesting.
What is your greatest failure, Mike, and what did you learn from it? I mean, something that you wish hadn't happened, but it did change you for the better.
When I assumed I knew how it all worked, when I felt I'd got it right. Now, this happened to me once when I was teaching at Lambda, and this was very early on in my career, and I taught first year acting, and each summer I would go away and revise and rethink the whole year course and come back with it refreshed. Now, after the fourth year, in which I'd had the most wonderful group of young students, and everything had flowed wonderfully, that summer I thought, I don't need to look at this work. I know how it works now. It's fine. And I came back in year five and presented my work, and it went down like cold sick. Nobody received enthusiastically. That whole year didn't go for it. And I realized it was because I was presenting it in such a possibly self-satisfied, I know and you don't know way, rather than saying, here's where I think we should go now. It was obviously deeply embedded in how I was presenting myself. Okay, yes, that was a big learning exercise. Once I did a lot of work in Israel. I did a production with a group of actors, and it was terrific. It was wonderful. And 6-7 years later, with more or less the same actors, I did another show. And the rehearsals were horrible. And I suddenly, because I thought, oh, I know these actors, this is how we'll work, it's all going to be wonderful. It was because in the intervening years, their careers had changed, their relationships had changed, the material we were working with was changed, their private lives have changed. Their relationship to me had changed because when they first worked with me, they didn't know me. Now they all thought they knew me, or they knew me in different ways. So everything had changed except our names, in a sense. And I changed.
Change is the only constant thing in life.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, Michael. And that's a painful thing because when you feel you've got life organized, it's very disruptive to change it. And as one gets older, it gets more and more difficult. I got very comfortable in lockdown. And when things started to open up, I got very jittery because I didn't know how to place myself. But to go back to the original question, the worst time that it happened for me was quite far into my career. I was very successful, you know, I'd run lots of companies. And out of a sort of laziness, I didn't think through my casting. I took a group of actors who I knew quite well, and I didn't. And the new actors, I didn't check. I met them in rehearsal. I liked them, but I didn't check on what their acting was like. I didn't do any workshops with them. And because of that laziness in casting, in not thinking through clearly, everything exploded in my face. It was really painful. And I couldn't solve it. And it was a tour. And it went on and on. And I used to go out and see the actors on tour week after week, dreading it, with my heart in my stomach, feeling just awful, because I could never solve it. And what I learned was, even the actors I loved and had known, they all somehow collectively wanted it not to go right. They wanted to be able to complain. So what would happen? I'd go down to Warwick or, I don't know, Southampton or wherever they were touring, do an afternoon's rehearsal, see the show in the evening and say, actually, that's much better, well done. I'd come back the next week and we're all back to square one again. Now, we were coming into London and we had a spare week and I said, look, please, why don't we re-rehearse the show in that week and see if we can solve things and get things going again and refresh it. Okay, so we did that and we actually had a wonderful week's rehearsal. Wonderful. And things were alive and all the things you said, spontaneous and immediate and moving. And I said, well done, well done. Oh, that's terrific. Thank you so much. I think we've licked it. And one of the actresses said, well, it's okay in rehearsal, but it won't be in performance.
Oh, wow.
At which point I actually lost my temper and said, you want to be unhappy. You want to have a grievance. Okay. Because I could see that that was the mode. And I remember, ironically, the show got quite good reviews. but the last performance, saying goodbye the last night, it was painful. It was painful. And that shocked me, because I thought, how could I have got myself into that situation after 40 years at least of working? But it was my fault, because I didn't initiate the casting and thinking it through carefully enough. Or I didn't integrate the new actors with the former actors enough, although I thought I did. I missed something. And maybe earlier in rehearsal, when I could have seen something, I didn't see it or didn't want to see it.
Is there anything in your personal life, Mike, that you'd say happened and you wish it didn't happen, but it made you a better person in the long run?
I guess I've been unkind to people I wanted to get rid of when I needn't have done it like that, shall we say.
Hmm.
And I think that wasn't necessary.
Yeah.
It's always when your ego takes over and you're reactive, when you don't think. Often we can all be caught unawares and respond inappropriately.
Yeah, it's the amygdala.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, it's that monster, that reptile in our brain. Yes, which is there. You haven't got rid of it. You know, evolution hasn't moved it. You're absolutely right, Michael. And it can catch you when you're vulnerable or weak. That's very, very painful. Yes, it's sort of losing a friendship or a relationship which wasn't necessary or could have been done more kindly or more sensitively. And it's partly about, I don't want to get hurt, trying to always think the other person's wrong. No, it's... I mean, I've made very big decisions in my life. I, first of all, when I was 18, I had to do English National Service. So I was in the Air Force and I was in Singapore for 2 years. And instead of coming back to England, I got a local demob. And I got on a cargo boat and I went to America and I loved it. And I decided to stay there. And then after 8 years, I decided I want to go back to England. And then after 8 years in England, I thought, no, I want to go and work in Israel. And then after about 6 years in Israel, I thought, I want to go back to England. And I don't know to this day if whether I was going to these places, whether I was running away from something or running towards something, if that makes sense for you. And I don't know. I found it very difficult to be totally honest with myself. I can't quite tell whether that all those, they were very big moves. They were big life-changing moves and they were all wonderful. And I learned so much from them. But Was it because the situation I was currently in made me unhappy, and so I, instead of dealing with it, I was running away from it? Or whether I was going somewhere because the possibilities and offers there were really what I needed.
It's a very interesting way of looking at it.
So, I mean, that's big things about my life. I have no idea.
So, wow. So you'd still say that up until this, you still don't know, basically?
No, I think it was 50-50. In one case, it was probably more. When I went to Israel, my career in England hadn't got going again, really. I'd been working at a drama school, Lambda, very successfully for 5 years. I'd done a bit of rep. And then I started to get invitations to go to Israel for reasons I won't go into now. And I did some work there that was absolutely adored, and I got flooded with work. And so I thought, well, if that's where the work is, why don't I go there? So it was probably a positive move because I could do what I wanted to.
I see, yeah.
But I didn't. And therefore, there was no reason for me to hang around in the UK where there wasn't those offers of work. And it did pay off for me in the long run, but it's very interesting.
What would be your main advice to someone who wants to succeed as an actor, director, theatre maker?
I mean, it depends what success you want.
Yeah, that's a good answer.
I mean, what do you mean by success? Be famous, earn lots of money. Yes, we all want that deep down.
I guess what I mean is succeed is, yeah, I mean, get better and better at your craft.
Oh, well, that's a very different matter.
And work with the people that's out of your control, right? To work with the people you want to work with.
Well, as a director, you certainly can. As an actor, it's much more difficult.
Yeah.
But
basically what I mean, I think, is fulfill your potential, like do what you love doing.
Well, I
most.
Think you've got to be very good at what you do, not to be a token. That means having a lot of craft. You see, skills you can acquire, art, your talent is your talent, and nobody can give it to you or take it away from you. It's your potential, and it's what you do with your talent. Because your talent can lie dormant if you don't provide it with the techniques to release it. So that's why I'm saying an actor should have this wonderful toolkit. They should take endless classes and really pursue those techniques which mean something to them. So they are skillful. Look, in recent years, I've gone back to doing quite a lot of third-year productions at drama schools, as you know. And I am appalled that lovely actors in the third year, I'm asking them, say, to play objectives in their scenes. And they are not masters of that. They were taught it in the first year. It was talked about, but it has not been drummed into them, exercised into them until it becomes second nature. So they know what they are. And that's true for most actors I meet. If I say, what's an objective? They'll tell me reasonably well. But when I go and watch them acting, are they playing an objective? No, because it is not part of their deep, profound, instinctive, automatic technique, which it should be.
Uh-huh, fair.
And so forth and so on. And that's when I say they're not ready. They've got lots of bits and pieces. They're not without skills. They can be very clever at simulating emotion. They can be very clever at pretending to be emotive. They can be very skillful at playing a line. That's all fine, but that's very superficial. And so I would say be very good at your job, because then under any circumstance, whether you have very little time or the director's lousy or the conditions are bad, you will come out of it with credit for yourself. So you can feel, I went into that and I did my very best under those circumstances.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, so because the effects or the outward success is out of your control anyway, but what you can do is invest in your instrument and
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In you as a human being who has chosen to be an actor, because it's an amazing job. And it's a job which is full of paradoxes. First of all, you are using yourself. You are your own instrument. You don't have a piano. You don't have a football. You don't have painted canvas. You don't have a slab of marble. You don't have clay. You are using you, but creating a performance is not about you, unless you're doing something autobiographical, which is a totally separate category. You are creating another human being, and it is not about you, but you are putting yourself, mind, body, emotions, at the disposal of this human being you're going to create for the audience. Mm-hmm. So that it means you've, although you're using you, it's not about your ego, it's not about your trauma, or how you felt when your mother got cancer or when your father died. It's about how the character felt. And of course, you will instinctively, if you're good, use your experience, but it's got to be filtered through what the character would do. And I'm so bored with actors when I say, what are you doing in this scene? Say, oh, I felt and I feel. Oh, and I remember when I was. I'm not interested.
I saw an interview with you on YouTube where you speak about the outside-in approach instead of the inside-out. So instead of the method and going into past experiences and trauma, you basically change something physical, like change your breath. And it's so effective. It's incredibly effective.
And it is as truthful. I'm not saying you shouldn't go inside out, but you should have both at your disposal, working together, in fact.
Yeah.
You should be holistic, you know, because...
More tools, basically.
Yes, but also, more specifically, Michael, is that and this has been, you know, sort of reinforced by the discoverers of neuroscientists, that our bodies are our first port of call. When something happens, our bodies instinctively are hardwired to react in a certain way.
Yeah.
If a loud bang went off now, we'd all, whoever we were, we'd all jump. After that, you get the feeling, oh. And then thirdly, the mind says, oh my God, there's a threat, I better run away or fight. Or the brain, the intellectual brain, comes last. The method of working is traditionally that the actor sort of, if I'm parodying it, if I say the actor traumatizes themselves, but the actors search within themselves for the feeling, and they try to feel, and they put themselves through all sorts of straining and stresses and upset themselves to very little effect. Whereas if I start to breathe shallowly, I will instinctively feel frightened.
Oh, yeah.
I just will. And that's truthful, do you see? And there is a guy, I always forget his name, I'm ashamed. His company is called PEM, PEM. And he used to do a lot of workshops in England. And he's over 10 years, 12 years, studied how the body works, how the organs work, how our nerves work. And he's created a series of ways of working, which when you put your body into certain conditions, it will automatically generate truthful feelings. I've done two or three workshops with him and observed him. And I was amazed because, for instance, I'm not a very aggressive person, you know, externally. I tend to hold my anger back. And when we did work on anger, suddenly I went into a whole other place, which was exhilarating. My voice dropped about an octave. I felt so free. I was so alive. And yet at the same time, I was in control. And the other, at the end of that, when you come out of it, it's very natural and you come out of it healthily. Whereas when actors, you know,
that's
particularly if they've worked on the method and gone through great traumas of weeping, and I remember.
You're drained, yeah.
They're drained and unhealthy.
Uh-huh.
I once worked in Canada with an actress who'd been trained in America in some sort of method. And every time we did an improvisation, it was an excuse for her to become hysterical.
Yeah.
It was all very exciting stuff. But all the other company had to calm her down. And her acting was totally uninteresting. It was all about her having hysteria. Theatre is not about therapy.
This technique is called PEM, yeah?
PEM. Yes, it's, you know, I'm suspicious of stuff sometimes of people, things that put you into an emotional state. But I experienced this myself and I thought, no, it's healthy.
It's funny, isn't it? It's quite easy in a way to impress people by crying a bit, and people think, oh,
yes,
that's a good actor. Deep inside, they know that that is actually not real or truthful or in the moment, but we feel like, oh, it's impressive because we see some tears.
Yes, and so, it's also because we're indoctrinated to feel that way because the critics have said you're so emotional to the actor.
Yeah, and then that's the reason why actors then in the end they kind of go that way, because they want to impress people and feel that, like, oh,
that's
yeah,
right, I've
done,
done it,
my
that's
job,
right,
yeah, yeah, I've,
yes,
done it.
And they give certain signals. So if the audience is sensitive, they say, oh, yes, I can imagine feeling that too. But if an actor really goes into a truthful place,
yeah,
the audience is transformed, because if the actor is really experiencing something, the audience will experience exactly the same thing. Their feelings, their body will change with it. So we all become one because... it's, you know, because it is real.
Yeah, when there's something real, it shakes you to your core, doesn't it?
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
And when it isn't real, you're kind of still observing it and you're like, oh, yeah, that's nice. Yeah,
That's a very good word, you're observing. You see, I think a lot of theatre goers, they go to the theatre and they consume. They're like consumers. Oh, nice set. Oh, she's good. Oh, that was a clever line. Oh, that was very exciting. Oh, he really got very angry then. Oh, that was very emotional. They're shopping. It's a sort of shopping list which they're ticking off. But when you go to the theatre and really get involved, you are participating like the actor. You are living with the actor. You're not judging. You're not... evaluating. That comes later, like when you go home, but you are experiencing something profoundly. You get lost.
Yeah, you get lost in the story, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, and the whole thing, which is very rare. I mean, all right, I know a lot about acting and I'm canny about it, and so it takes a lot to fool me. So I go to the theatre and I'm watching and I'm just thinking, I don't care. I don't care. I don't believe you. I don't believe you. I don't believe you. I don't care. And that's awful, because I go to the theatre because I want to care.
Mm.
I want to be touched by the actor's humanity.
That leads me to my next question. Why is it important to tell stories? Why is good theatre important?
A lot of theatre doesn't tell stories, but I always feel that's a different branch of art, sort of performance art. It's an area I don't quite like, because I feel it falls between too many stools. I believe theatre in its essence is very pure. It's the actor telling a story to an audience, in which that actor may play one role or many roles. And whether you have scenery or costumes or anything else is almost beside the point, depending on the style of the play. It's because we want to understand why we need stories, is because we want to understand ourselves. It's instinctively, we want to see, why do people do that? We're trying to understand. We're looking for beginnings, middles, and maybe ends. We don't know, but we need to understand what it means to be human. It's so profound in us to be told myths and stories. It's essential. Why do these long drama series work now? Because we want to be told stories. When I go to the theatre, and everything is happening except the story's not being told, I switch off. Oh, the brilliant set. Oh, the clever symbolism. That's why I, apart from the first show of his I saw, View from the Bridge, I find Ivo van Hove's work not interesting. It's full of effects, because he is not telling me a story. I mean, I just sit there and I think, well, I don't believe you're Heather Gabler. I don't believe you're whoever you are. So what? Who cares? Oh, that effect was very impressive. Oh, I'm very impressed by that effect. That was a clever effect. So what? If you want to go to theatre for effect, go for circuses, go and watch a magician. That's not what theatre, what drama is for me. It's about human beings trying to find a truth. And I don't mean it's being realistic. You can play Shakespeare with the most heightened language. You can perform at the most heightened level, but it can have its truth.
Yeah, it's funny how deeply storytelling's ingrained in us, isn't it? As we're the storytelling animal. Yeah. We kind of need stories to...
Yeah, we want to talk about ourselves. That's why we always talk about ourselves.
We love talking about ourselves, yeah. We love that, yeah.
Good theatre, a play, is about telling a story, but really telling it.
How do you embrace uncertainty in your work and life? How do you let go of that need to control everything?
Well, it happened quite comfortably because when I started to see that you didn't have to block everything and stage everything, it was like a relief in a funny way. I mean, my wonderful American training had been in that tradition of you block everything, you plan the production in advance, you work it all out, you then share that with the actors, and with a few adjustments, that's what you do. At the same time, we were being taught about improvising and being in the moment, and those things didn't quite coalesce. How can I be in the moment if I know what I'm going to do next?
Yeah, if everything's blocked.
Yes. So quite by chance, one day when I was teaching at Lambda, I was doing Heather Gabler, actually, with quite a eventually starry cast, I didn't know at the time. And I thought, God, you're all being so boring. I mean, I did use a lot of improvisation in rehearsals. And I said, OK, I want you all to do that scene again. And I want you to change everything. Where you move, how you play a line, even your entrances, but you must justify them. You can't just arbitrarily do it. You've got to find a reason for that. And bless those actor souls, because of them, my work changed, because they did the scene again, and it was amazing. And they were amazed, and I was amazed. And you thought, oh my God, that's the way you do it. And I just built a structure on that.
So that was a turning point for you.
That was a big turning point. I mean, I had other structures at work, like objectives, way back when I was doing some classes in New York. And I observed people, a director saying to actors, now play the scene with your objective, how suddenly everything worked better. So there were lots of moments in my life which were leading me to this point. All my subconscious was looking for that and noticed it when it came in front of me. But yes, I did find ways that took me where I wanted to go. And so over the years, I developed that. I mean, so my productions are full of chance and change. They're all about change, different every night, because you can't be the same every night. Very painful, you have to adjust. And you, in life, you get into patterns, and it's so difficult to change.
Do you apply that in your life as well?
I try to, but it's more difficult as I get older. I have a routine. I wake up terribly early. So I'm much happier working in the morning and not at night. Whereas when I used to teach at Lambda, I could have worked from 8 o'clock in the morning to 2 o'clock in the morning without a break. I had so much energy. Now, I don't feel creative after about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I really don't want to work. So I try to avoid doing workshops that are late.
What time do you wake up?
I wake up, at the moment I'm getting up at 4 o'clock.
Wow. And I heard that you do Pilates in the morning
as well.
Yes,
I do. Yes, I get up and it's the first thing I do.
This is incredible.
For the last few years I've got up at 5 o'clock. Because it gives me time to do Pilates.
Oh, you were slacking, Michael. Come on, 5 o'clock. That's a bit late.
No, because to do an hour of Pilates. And then I love breakfast, and to sit down and have a really nice breakfast quietly and do a crossword or something is very healthy. Now, if I have to rush and not have a breakfast, I'm very bad tempered, do you see? And sometimes I have to, and I don't like it. So there are times when I've just got to do that. And what the problem with being the lockdown and everything, I've got into a pattern of living, which has reinforced my own pattern. So it's been very difficult to break that pattern. It was very interesting when we could first go, because, you know, I was in that category of you on the danger list because of my age, because I'm in my mid-80s, but I'm actually very well. I feel very healthy.
For our audience, you're 86 now, right?
Yeah.
And this is incredible. So you wake up and you do Pilates. It's the first thing.
Yes,
it's like,
yes.
I mean, it's such a wake-up call, I think, for myself and a lot of people who are like, oh, today I'm a bit tired. Maybe I won't do it, you know.
Yes, well, I overcome that. And And I'm sensible. If my body is in a certain state, I'll do 45 minutes. If it's going well, I'll do an hour and 10 minutes, or wow, I'll do 50 minutes, or I'll do. Yeah. But I have to make sure my body is moving and everything. And it's vital because, and our work is very sedentary. And lockdown was wonderful for having a walk because I've got into the habit of walking every morning. So what I've been doing since lockdown is getting up at, you see, I need to get up at 4 o'clock. And I did this because as the light got lighter, as the days got longer, it was easy to wake up at 4 o'clock. So I do my Pilates. I then get dressed, go into for a walk in the park, which is very near me, for another half an hour, 45 minutes. Then come back and have breakfast. But I'd already done about getting dressed and showered. It had already got beyond 6 o'clock. It was 6:30, and the morning was catching up with me. If I did it any later, it was pushing the day on in a funny way. So, I mean, I honestly don't know how much longer it'll be 4 o'clock when the days get really short and cold. Because I'm very bad in the winter. I hate it. I become so reclusive. It's a real problem. But I think it's very good to have a pattern and a discipline from which, if you have to, you can shift.
No, you have to be flexible and adaptable, yeah.
Absolutely. Yes, that's right.
In everything in life anyway, right? You have to have your principles and your values, but you have to adapt like according to the situation.
Yes. Yeah. You say, in this circumstance, is it worth me holding on to my principles? It's not going to get me anywhere. It's just going to damage things. So in this case, give.
I do have another question, though. I mean, I have to ask this. So
okay.
Mark Rylance basically said about you that you're the best acting teacher he's ever had. How did you enjoy working with him?
Well, Mark he's a natural actor. You know, I talk about being ready to work. He just comes with energy and he's there. He's totally present. And the few starry actors or well-known actors I've worked with, they all do have this thing. They come ready to work. They are there, 100% present in the room, ready to go.
Yeah.
There's no messing around. And Mark is just so totally imaginative. He's so playful. You give him an inch and he runs. And it's wonderful. And he just takes off. That's all I can say. And glorious.
So this childlike quality of
curiosity. Curiosity. And that's, of course, what an actor needs to hold on to, the childlikeness.
Yes, yeah, so true.
So life doesn't make you cynical as an actor.
I listened to a very interesting interview with Brian Cox where he says, keep carrying a picture of you as a child with you so you're reminded of that playful energy. I found that quite interesting.
No, I think that's absolutely right, because remember, acting is also playing. You've got to be playful. You know, it's not all agony. There are a lot of actors who think they've got to suffer.
Yeah, torture.
Unless it's torture and it's painful. And you think, no, it's not. It doesn't have to be. Yes, we're serious, but you're playful in a serious way.
That's such a great way of putting it. It's why we actually started doing it, isn't it? Because when we were kids, we felt so playful and free.
Yes.
And we're trying to recreate that situation of
you know, yeah. So you're playfully serious and seriously playful. And the two things have to be in the bed. The other thing is, with two actors I've just adored working with a lot, an actor called John Ram, who's done a lot of wonderful work. He was half of the National Theatre of Brent for a while. He's done lots of work for the RSC, and a wonderful actress called Pam Ferris, who actually ended up doing a lot of television. But those two actors, they loved being in rehearsal. They wanted to rehearse. They were available and accessible and explored. They just loved it. There was no resistance. There was no argument. They just were happy being there, being creative. And I think for both of them, if I can say this about them, they having a career was probably second to having the pleasure of being creative. You know, they were ambitious, obviously, but they were so happy to work. They'd often both and say, oh, I was very lucky to get that role. And I was thinking, no, that director was bloody lucky to get you. They were very self-effacing. Their ego didn't get in their way. And they were just joyful. And I appreciate those actors, particularly Pam, who I worked with for over 5 years. because she taught me so much. And she was such a joy to know that an actor could be like that. Of course, I've worked with other actors who've been wonderful in many ways. And there's a list of them. I won't go through Sean Thomas, all sorts of lovely people. But she had this particular quality. And she could make costumes. And she could paint the set. And the other thing is, she didn't talk much. But when she said something, you listened because it was relevant. And she'd say things like, Mike, I have to ask you, why are you asking us to do it this way when 2 days ago we were doing it that way? And she would point out an inconsistency that I hadn't noticed or had ignored.
Oh, you
know, so very, very interesting. So, no, I mean, my pleasure is working with actors. Probably sound very negative, you know, they're not prepared to do the work, they're not ready. But actually, most of my pleasure in life, a big, huge chunk of it, has been working with actors in rehearsal room and watching them be creative and giving and exploring and playing. It's been my great, great pleasure and joy. And my greatest achievement for me when I feel I've been able to create the environment in which the actor could truly be creative and make discoveries which they might not have been able to do under other circumstances.
That's so interesting. That's what I noticed when I sat in some of your rehearsals, is that people were so alive and they were really trying things. And oftentimes I noticed that when you're in a rehearsal room, actors are okay. And then when the opening night is near, they suddenly up their game, right? Suddenly they try harder.
Sure. Yeah.
But in your rehearsals, I noticed that there was always this atmosphere of,
yes.
We're just trying things in a relaxed way, but it was so bold. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. No, because that means, the first night's important.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it hasn't been that important till now. That is a very traditional, cliched, old-fashioned way of thinking about the actor. Got to get it right for the first night.
For the press, yeah.
There's no right. You've got to be good all the time because for your own self-respect. And then you'll got to be good for any audience who's come to see you.
Also, it's much more fun that way.
And if the press like it, good. But if they don't, what could I do? I did my best. No, if the actor's focus is going on pleasing the audience or impressing the press, they are not playing truthfully. They're showing off. They're saying, wasn't I good? Did you like me? And that's wrong. And it's very difficult for actors not to. Or they could be thinking, what did the director tell me? Oh, what was that line, that note Mike gave me? And I'm always saying to actors, look, I'm going to give you some notes. Think about them. Forget about them. If those notes keep coming back, think about them more. Because I do not want you to go into a performance playing notes. Because you've got to go into performance playing what is happening. So you've got to think about that note or explore what it means and hopefully it will find its place. Actors have to absorb things, particularly if it's a note which should deal with something quite deeper in the character. If it's a practical thing like, oh, make sure the door's open because it's safer, then yes, they should sort of remember that. But no, if you're after asking actors to do something, you're asking them to deal with their psyche. And actors, for the best will in the world, they cannot give you results to order. That's why you have to go through a process. I can't I want you to be more emotional here. I want you to be angrier here. I want you to be happier here. Well, the actor can't just suddenly be happier. They can pretend to be, you know, that awful external way, but it won't be truthful. They've got to find that within an organic, truthful process, which hopefully my way of working allows them to do.
What are your plans for the future?
It's almost impossible for me to say, because here I am at my age, the virus around, thinking, ooh, am I ever going to be able to go into a room with a group of actors again? I was meant to be doing a co-production for RADA next month. Because of various things, I thought they're going to go ahead, but it's got to be socially distanced and they've got to wear masks. And they broke the group up into bubbles, which meant that I wouldn't have all the acts I wanted to do. Also, I was wanting to co-direct with somebody because we've worked together before and we wanted to see each other's work, and it seemed like a very nice place to do that. It meant that we would each have half of that class of that year, so we wouldn't see each other's work. I wouldn't have the necessary number of actors I wanted. And I was also going to be locked into a rehearsal room for 4 or 5 weeks, six hours a day minimum, with a group of people who knows what infections they might bring in with them in a rather rehearsal space, which may or may not be well ventilated, depending on how old the building was. And I suddenly thought, well, there are so many things working against it. I don't see much point in me doing it artistically, for health's sake, for collaboration's sake. And it's fine. The other director will very happily do the whole thing, and it'll probably be much simpler in the long run. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm trying to write a third book, because some of what I've touched on with you today has been some deeper discoveries or realizations I've had about the actor's work. It's nothing new, but I suppose more profoundly, that the actor, in order to play truthfully, the actor has to be in touch with their subconscious. But you cannot intellectually get in touch with your subconscious. I mean, that's not what's on the tin. You know, subconscious means it's not available. And so you've got to put yourself into a state where you can possibly allow the subconscious to emerge, and then allow it to take over you. As actors, you've got to allow things to happen rather than trying to make them happen.
How do you get into that state? Is it the process again?
It's a process, and it's very much, I mean, more and more for me, the objective. The character having a need, which the actor truly makes their own. So it's not just an intellectual idea, but it's organically in their body, profoundly in their body, will lead you towards that. Because if I truly want something, I get in and I want, let's say I'm saying, I'm an actor playing a scene with you, Michael, and I really believe I want you to sympathize with me and be on my side and support me. If I can believe that and I say, Michael, please, you know, you've got to understand my situation and support me. You've always been a friend and a mate, my mate in the past. All right, I know the other people you're friendly with too, but please, please, out of this condition. And I really, really work hard to get you. And you are reacting either saying, no, I can't, or yes, I will. It will evoke spontaneous feelings in me.
Yeah.
I won't have to create those feelings. They will be there automatically.
So how do you get your objective into your body as opposed to just superficially have an objective?
This is the big problem, and I've never found a simple exercise. I'm struggling all the time. First of all, having your body in a good condition, and then trying to say to the actor, get it out of your head and see if you can drop it into your stomach somewhere. Feel that need. If I truly want something from you, if I get it in life, this is, I will instinctively feel happy, relieved, joyful, complacent, because I've got what I wanted. Now, if I don't get what I want from you, I will be angry, upset, insecure, depressed, humiliated. Those feelings will instinctively arise in me. I don't have to work to get them. So all the time that actors are trying to feel, are trying consciously to reach emotion, is fake.
Yeah, of course.
Do you see? So if you could learn to embody an objective inside yourself, get it out of your head and into your body in some way.
And it's probably got to do with in a way, putting it into your own words and really owning those words.
That's right, yeah. Yes. Yes, Michael, that's very good. Because often the way an objective is phrased can mean something to me when I suggest it to an actor, but it may not mean anything to that actor. The words are stimulating.
Yeah, so I've just realised that members of our audience who are not actors or directors will find this quite technical, this stuff we're talking about.
Well, it doesn't matter, because I think it's interesting if people know that acting is a difficult, complicated job. It's going out on stage with your natural talent and emoting.
Yeah.
Much more complicated. It's very interesting. Analysts are very interested in actors. And I know a lot of actors who've given up acting and have become psychiatrists and analysts because they're very closely allied.
What's the best way for people to find you or get in touch with you?
I have a very poor face online. I've never written, there's a very bad Wikipedia entry that somebody else put in for me, which is all inaccurate. I don't have a website. What people have done who need me, they often look me up and see I'm doing a workshop somewhere, and they often phone that company who ask me if I'll talk to them. I mean, I suppose my publishers, Nick Hearn, have been very good in the past. When people have contacted them to get hold of me, they've called me up and said, this person wanted to talk to you, do you want to? I probably should have a website. I've never got round to doing it because I try to avoid social media because I feel it's a bit of a nightmare. It's a trap, I don't know. I'm probably missing a lot. I'm probably missing out a great deal.
It's funny because it's a tool, right? But in a weird way, the tool can start using you the way it's designed. Suddenly you become a slave of this tool.
If I were running a company now, we'd obviously be using social media, so it'd be very different. But what I'm going to do in the future, I don't know how much longer it'll last, but I'm teaching a lot online and Zooming, and I'm enjoying it a lot. And I'm finding all sorts of ways, doing classes on play analysis. I just did a Laban workshop last week. I do on the rehearsal process. Anything I can teach in a rehearsal room, I'm doing online. I'm doing a certain amount of coaching online, and I'm finding it in the moment reasonably satisfying. It's not a bad surrogate. It's almost a surrogate, but it's not totally it anyway.
Thanks so much, Michael. This has been truly fascinating.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Thank you for listening. If you find this podcast valuable, there are many ways you can support it. You can leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you happen to listen to it, and you can share it on social media. It really does help other listeners find us. And make sure to subscribe to get the next episode. Thanks so much for your support.